Live from the greatest city, the greatest state, and the greatest country on the second greatest planet in the solar system, it's another episode of Midday with Trey minus BK. On today's show at 11, we're continuing the Horns College Football Top 20 with number 14 USC, which we'll preview with former Trojans wide receiver and current radio analyst John Jackson. At 10:30, where are we at in society? You should probably stop peeing in the pool now. And in mere minutes, we're talking Texas Longhorn football with Joe Cook of Inside Texas in studio. I'm Trey Elling, behind the glass today, filling in for the Horns fantasy sports expert and one-time gigolo Adam Wagner. It is Dylan Fry. What's up, Dylan? How you doing today?
How's it going, guys?
It's going pretty well. And filling in for the one Junacy of Gentiles here at the Horn, the managing editor at Inside Texas, he is Justin Wells.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful. No yelling on the bus.
So as you, the listeners, can probably tell by now, this is going to be an Inside Texas heavy week here on the Midday Show. It always is. We have Joe Cook on regularly. He's in studio with us right now. Justin Wells, of course, filling in for Brad Kellner, who is still on vacation. Somehow survived. His liver survived, that is. His short trip to Chicago. I believe he's in New York City now. So he will hopefully have some great stories to tell us when he's back in the chair that Justin is occupying on Monday. But in the meantime, Justin Wells is in studio to talk plenty more Texas Longhorn football and more. And we're also welcoming Joe Cook into the studio now as well. Joe, thank you so much for joining us in here today.
Hey, man, it's great to be here.
Justin, for you, this is day two for you in studio. Is there anything that we need to change up from day one? I guess I probably should have asked you that off the air, but we like to air our dirty laundry when the microphones are actually on.
No, I think yesterday we covered so many bases on a very busy weekend that started a little quiet and then got a little crazy. And so I think we hit a lot of points yesterday, probably some more stuff we may need to touch on today. So I think the dirty laundry, it's looking good, Don Henley style.
Now, Joe, you've covered a number of the practices so far this fall for the Texas Longhorns. You've been a part of those 20 to 30 minute windows of actually getting to see who's where, to write down basic ideas of depth charts and things like that. So through this first almost 2 weeks now, what are some of the biggest impressions you have from getting to watch this football team and also getting to speak with Coach Herman and players after the practices themselves?
One thing I continue to notice is that there's no starting over. Everybody kind of knows where to go. Defense is led the right way. There's no like, hey, you need to be here. There's not a whole lot of like, hey, you're in the wrong spot. There is sometimes of that's happening with freshmen, but Gary Johnson's right there to make sure it happens. It's fixed right away. Last year around this time, there were so many opportunities for messing up that everybody took. It was a lot of, no, you're in the wrong spot. Coaches telling people, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be here. There's almost none of that this year, and anything like that is taking care of the players.
You mentioned Gary Johnson as being a key communicator on defense. Is there anybody else on that side of the ball who's doing a good job of making sure the message is fully understood by everybody else on the field? And on the flip side, is there anybody on the offensive side of the ball who's really taken the reins in terms of communicating with some of the younger guys or guys who maybe don't know what should be going on at that point?
I think on the defensive line, even though their sets are fairly simple, you can see guys like Breckenhager and Charles Omenihu able to call and tell people you need to be in this spot. On the offense, it's really guys like Patrick Vahe. It's those guys who have been in this program for a long time who are doing the best with this. And, I mean, Patrick Vahe, say what you will about his play, he knows what to do in this offense now. Even though this is his fourth guy in 4 years, he knows where to be. He has the respect of the team. It's very evident while he's out there. And he just makes sure guys know where to go and where to block.
Talking about the offensive line, throughout the spring, we've written at Inside Texas numerous times about the potential of Derek Kerstetter playing some center. And we know that Herb Hand likes to cross-train a lot of these guys. And Saturday scrimmage, he was running with the ones and the twos at center. And he had been primarily at right tackle there for a while. What are your thoughts on Kerstetter playing some of that center? And what do you make of that kind of development and Herb Hand basically looking like he's trying to get the best five possible for week one?
Couple things. One, Kerstetter, even as a recruit, was a guy who could play a bunch of different spots. I believe he played tackle in high school, but once he got to the Under Armour or the Adidas Army All-American game, he was put at guard and center. And he was a lower-rated guy. You know, some people weren't as excited when that flip from Oklahoma State happened. Like, right. I don't know, another three-star lineman. But he was going up against five-star defensive tackles, and he held his own really, really well during that game. He made sure that the ball was blocked for and that passer was kept pretty upright. He got to Texas, and although right tackle was where he was this past year, he always had that ability to kind of be like Elijah Rodriguez, but kind of with a little bit more in his game than Elijah. And Elijah's good in his own right. He can do a lot in his own right, but at the same time, Derek's got an ability to do all that and a little bit better. So his 6'5 length, his extra year in the strength and conditioning program has kind of put him in a better position to be able to work on the interior. And so far, if they trust him at center, that says a lot, because that's where the play starts every time. You don't want mistakes from there. That's what happened. That's what has happened a lot with Texas this past year, and that's another opportunity to increase the strength in the interior while having reliable snaps. Kerstetter could be the guy.
No doubt about that, and it also says something about what they think of him in terms of his interior abilities, they being Herb Hand primarily. Because Texas, if they have more depth anywhere on the offensive line right now, it is the interior. It's at the guard position. It's potentially at the center position as well. Of course, you have a two-year starter coming back at the center position. And moving Kerstetter inside gives you another option, perhaps your best option at the center position, while also allowing you to work some of those other guys that you're hopeful can really step up and take that next step in terms of their development at the tackle position. Guys like Denzel Okafor and Sam Cosmi as well.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what Herb Hand's trying to accomplish. You know, he mentioned it in our media session a couple weeks ago, where when he was first hired, you know, you have to go through, it's a long process to actually become the coach in the state of Texas. You have to go the background checks and things of that sort. So he couldn't really recruit just yet. So he was stuck in a room full of videos and watched all of the offensive line play last year just to kind of see what he was going to get to work with and you know, what he could tinker with, what he could mold and things of that sort. We talked about it yesterday. Cosmi redshirting kind of gave a couple of these other guys, gave him the advantage, because like Coach McKnight said, they almost get another offseason, another opportunity to lift and to develop without having to worry about, you know, game time, game planning, game, you know, stuff like that. And so with Cosmi, you know, they're looking at him at both tackles. Okafor, who started off at left tackle at the beginning of the fall camp, we know that Calvin Anderson, that's probably going to be his spot. But Okafor's growing. He's getting better practice by practice. If you've got, you know, some depth there, we talked about in the interior, there's plenty of bodies, but it's those tackles that really, you know, mold that line together to make sure the quarterback has that extra couple seconds for that play to happen. With that, with Cosmi, with Okafor, and with Kerstetter being so versatile, Texas is starting to see some actual depth.
Joe, if you had to guess what the starting offensive line looks like for that very first week versus Maryland, who would you go with? Obviously, Calvin Anderson at left tackle, Patrick Vahe at left guard, but things become a little bit muddled after that. So who do you have center through the right tackle positions?
Honestly, before this past weekend where we started to learn that Kerstetter was at center, my projected starting lineup was Anderson, Vahe, Shackelford, Hudson, and then Kerstetter.
Now that Hudson, really?
Yeah, okay. I thought he was going to take over at right guard over fall camp, and I know he didn't start out starting there,
right?
But I thought over the course of fall camp, he'd be a guy that surged and would take that first spot. Now that we kind of know that Kerstetter has taken this center role and done really well with it, I still think it's going to be Anderson and Vahe on the left side. Kerstetter definitely, I think, has moved into that number one center spot, just because if he can get more reliable play like you got from him at right tackle last year at center, that helps the interior of the defense, where a lot of the where the magic happens as far as inside zone goes. So exactly. To his right, I still think it's Hudson. Right tackle, that becomes a big question. There's plenty of guys there like Denzel Okafor, Sam Cosmi, J.P. Urquidez, and that may become the biggest competition of the camp. And I think at this point of those three, you have to think it would be Okafor at this point, just because of his experience playing the spot and having live action better than some of those other guys.
Guys, I have to be a little bit surprised to see Urquidez's name in the ones and the twos at the right tackle position. It may be just a matter of them testing him out there, but it also shows that they're looking at every possible option to make sure that they have depth at both tackle positions.
JP is a kid that he was one of the Baylor kids that Texas basically flipped when all the Bryles situation went down. He's got a big frame. I think he's 6'6", 6'7". 7. He's got a lot of athletic ability. He was just really raw, and he's still kind of raw. He's one of those that you have to develop over time, but you know, there's you can't coach that size. And Herb Hand's trying to get the most out of what he can. As for right guard, I'm with Joe on Patrick Hudson from an upside standpoint. Mm-hmm. We've seen him in high school. Like I've talked about before, his run blocking is basically huddle porn. I mean, it's unbelievable when he latches on, no man gets apart. But at the same time, Elijah Rodriguez is probably the most trusted lineman in this group. He is probably the guy that not only Herb Hand at this point, but Coach Herman and Coach Beck trust because of so many things he can do. And so I actually think he, or maybe even Tope Amade, who I've been described as has been playing beautiful, that right guard is now we've actually got some guys. It's not, oh, just the best available. It's, hey, there's two or three, possibly four options here. You can actually put out the best five and then have a nice little two-depth, two-string, two-line, with that position and others. And so, you know, right guard, I think it's going to be Elijah Rodriguez. I think Hudson has the most potential. But just, you know, talking about him and Urquidez and those guys, I just can't remember the last time we were able to talk in depth about the Texas offensive line actually being better, trending high, and becoming a strength.
And I've been harping on this going back to last season now, that if you do find somebody else to take over at the center position, I think Zach Shackelford could be a great option at one of the guard spots.
Absolutely.
Too. Now, it's going to take him a little bit of time to transition over and get comfortable to those positions, but at some point this year, if you see Shackelford taking over at center, maybe Elijah Rodriguez is who ends up backing him up at that center position. Perhaps we do see Shackelford slide out and provide more depth at one of the guard spots.
Yeah, I think he's taken some reps at practice in previous years, taking some reps at practice there this year. He's shown an ability to be able to block pretty well. It's not anything exceptional, but there's some good film from Shackelford. And if you remove him having to snap the ball, which we all saw him struggle with so often last year, maybe that'll improve his play a little bit more.
And don't forget about Zach. He was a freshman All-American.
That's right. I mean, he was. So he possesses the ability, but it's that thing that you see with a lot of guys who are forced into action their freshman years, that it almost messes up their long-term development because they don't get that extra year in the strength and conditioning program like you're talking about with Sam Cosmi last year, where he pretty much gets an extra offseason during the year, and it has a way to affect the overall development. We've seen that out of a guy like even Patrick Vahe, who doesn't seem to have gotten a whole lot better from his freshman through his junior years, and part of that is through no fault of his own, because he's been forced into action from day one of him setting foot on campus.
I agree. And don't forget, Shackelford's had that ankle has been nagging for 2 years. That's an injury that he tried, you know, he did regress a little bit last year. But
and that's something that went back to high school too, correct?
Absolutely. This is something that's been a kind of a reoccurring thing, which this is why I think this is the mindset of Texas right now. It's, you know, Shackelford, you know, McKnight told us how much he's grown in their power index, becoming like one of the stronger guys in the interior. But at the same time, Coach Herman knows this guy's had a reoccurring injury for 3 years, so why don't they make sure and get some backup, you know, make sure who can slide in. Elijah Rodriguez was one that, you know, he can play some center, but to me, Kerstetter's ceiling was center, because a lot of times, and we've said this before, some of the smartest guys on the team are on the offensive line, and a lot of times the smartest guy is the center, and Derek Kerstetter fits that perfectly. Joe described it really well from watching him at the Army All-American Combine. I mean, he was one of the lowest rated guys, and he's dominating five stars, and he actually started in that game and played very well. And so you got to have a backup. You've got to have a second option, not only because if Shaq has a problem with late game snaps again, but from that ankle. Is it, you know, right now it's fully healthy, but how long will that sustain? We've had 3 years of it now. That's got to be in the back of Coach Herman's mind.
And I think one thing we've seen is that even though there's a two deep, whoever may be that backup left guard may not be the next guy. The point in Tom Herman's system is to have a top eight, top nine that they trust. So even if, let's say, you know, left guard goes down, that's where Elijah Rodriguez, as kind of being the sixth man, would slide right in, not whoever might be behind him directly on the depth chart. So having that top eight was something Texas did not have for pretty much most of the season last year. and going into the first game at Maryland, if they can keep a top eight, even top nine group, that'll make this offense go a lot easier this year.
Since the subject of injuries has come up, I would be remiss not to ask Joe's opinion on what's going to happen at the linebacker position right now. Inevitably, each and every year, the position with the thinnest amount of depth ends up being the one hit hardest by injuries in preseason. And although we have seen injuries at other position groups, Devontae Davis tweaked a hamstring, he may be out a couple more days, it's the linebacker group that has suffered injury after injury. Now, some of these guys are already back on the field. Gary Johnson suffered a stinger late last week. We saw him back this weekend. But Joe, considering how we're seeing the injuries starting to pile up at the linebacker position, how do you think that affects them, not just for the position group, but also with Todd Orlando, how he maybe changes what he's doing schematically to protect the entire defense against not having enough bodies out there at the three different linebacker spots?
I think you saw part of it or that begin last year. There were really, in my opinion, there were three, four guys at that inside linebacker spot that they could trust. Malik, Gary, and then Jeffrey McCulloch as the year went on. And Anthony Wheeler, mm-hmm. who as it had experience there, and that led to him playing a lot more.
Played a great bowl game, too.
Right, and now there's even fewer numbers there. I think what you saw was that he developed this 3-2-6 defense in order to accentuate his strongest position of DB and to minimize the guys on the field he needed from his weakest position. I think you'll just continue to see more wrinkles from that package this year. And I think that if with that's the case, you can be thin at linebacker. Definitely not a great thing now that Edwin Freeman's transferred, that Jeffrey McCulloch may be out up to that first game at Maryland. But at this point,
which if he's out up to that first game, it's hard to imagine him playing a whole lot in that first game too, right, guys?
In theory, it really just matters to the pace of the game, what Maryland comes out and does on offense. Orlando's going to have to get creative. He's going to. And so McCulloch's one of those that he's been through the system now for a full year. He's a really smart guy. That's a guy that you could kind of plug and play in a couple spots. And so, it's hard to gauge how much he would play against Maryland. But if it's a spot where there's, a few dings here and there, he may not have a choice.
Joe, you mentioned that 3-2-5. Would it behoove this defense to maybe run a little bit, or the 3-2-6 rather, would it behoove this defense to maybe run a little bit of 4-2-5 this year, especially against those run-happy teams like Maryland in week one, like TCU, like Kansas State, possibly even like USC as well, if they end up starting the true freshman quarterback with a more established offensive line and running backs that they have some faith in, it may not be a bad idea to go with that four down lineman look, considering how much depth exists up front for this defense.
Right, and Tom Herman talked about this weekend. I asked him, what does the personnel look like when you go from three down lineman to four? And he said, the B-backer puts his hand in the ground, goes to five technique. A defensive end, whether it be Hager or Menahou, depends on what side the call is, moves to three technique. Chris Nelson goes to the one technique, and then the other defensive end is at the other five. So it's just basically that would help a lot. But I think what you're going to see with Maryland, and I'm not sure how much Maryland you've discussed prior to this, but that's a brand new offensive system with now interim head coach Matt Canada. Mm-hmm. And I take a passing interest in LSU. I watched kind of how it went up and down last year with Ed Ogeron and Matt Canada butting heads over motion. That's one way that you can attack this special defense. I talked to some of the Fox Sports guys at Big 12 Media Days, and one of the things I asked was, how do you get through this 3-2-6 defense? And they said, one of the only ways I can really think of is having a lot of motion. That way you can try and get guys out of their static looks or into more static looks, so you can't disguise maybe blitzes, where one DB is coming from, where the other's coming from, and that's Matt Canada's bread and butter. Motion, motion, motion. So I think, yes, against a running type team, a four down lineman look may be what you're looking for. But if you trust a guy like Malcolm Roach at B backer, you may be able to get by and run the three down lineman and just run a base nickel look.
I have to admit that that makes me a little bit nervous, because they may need Malcolm Roach to play one of the other linebacker positions depending on the point in the ball game, and also because you have other big bodies who can play more of that traditional four down lineman defensive end look. I wonder if Texas isn't better off maybe just going with more of a straight up defensive end type at that position instead of the B backer, so that Malcolm Roach can be back there with Gary Johnson or somebody else playing in that second level, because he is a guy who can not only take on blocks, but he possesses the ability to really get around in open space, too.
And Roach, that's the beauty of his versatility. You know, I asked him when we got to speak with the players a couple weeks ago, how many positions have you played at Texas? And he said, well, I've played along all the front seven, so seven positions.
Yeah.
And that's Malcolm Roach, his career, you know, microcosm right there at University of Texas. I think his best spot is Mac. I think that's obvious, and he's going to be there when Wheeler sets out for the first half of Maryland. But he has some B-backer experience. I don't think I would want him at Rover. I wouldn't mind him with his hand in the dirt, you know, in a four-man front.
Occasionally. But, you don't want it that way all the time,
right?
Because he moves so well in space, though.
And that, because once you get into Big 12 play and you get to face these spread guys every week, they'll find that mismatch. And him trying to cover a slot is not an ideal matchup there. And Coach Orlando is not going to put him in that position, especially at 270 pounds.
Absolutely. He is Justin Wells filling in for Brad Kellner all week, who's on vacation. Joe Cook also joining us in studio right now. You can read those guys' work over at InsideTexas.com. It's free from now until the week of the USC game. Go check it out right now. It is well worth the price of membership. I know, because I am a member. I'm not just saying that because these guys are sitting next to me right now. I am tried and true a believer in what Inside Texas does. You should be as well. Coming up next, we'll talk more Texas football. We'll also take our first look at the Horns' top 20 number 14 team, USC, and it'll be today's edition of Where Are We At in Society. This is the Midday Show, minus BK, plus Justin Wells and Joe Cook for the 10 o'clock hour, and this is the Horn.
I want to break free.
Queen.
I want to break free. I want to break free.
Back here on Midday with Trey and BK, Dylan Fry filling in for Adam Wagner amongst those out this week. Adam Wagner is taking part in his kids' orientation this morning, so happily giving him the day out. Dylan, any reason why we're playing Queen right now?
Well, during the morning show today, we talked about the top 100 singers that Rolling Stone put out a few years ago, since Aretha Franklin is actually on her deathbed, and this was one of them. So,
yeah, Freddie Mercury, I believe he was trained operatically as well. So
really?
He was a trained opera singer, which is why he can belt it like he can.
And can't wait for that movie to come out.
Yeah, with the cat who stars in Mr. Robot.
Yes.
Yeah, that he looks exactly like him. He's a great actor. I'm with you on that one. I'll look forward to that. On top of the fact that Freddie Mercury supposedly had a pretty incredible life story as well.
Yeah, it seems like a very good movie.
Big Queen fan, Justin?
Absolutely. I mean, We Will Rock You, Bohemian Rhapsody. Queen was
Fat Bottom Girls.
Under Pressure with David Bowie. I mean, I could go on. They were a little bit before my time, but it's still, you know, it was good classic rock with an androgynous taste.
Real quick look at the Specs text line. By the way, that's Justin Wells right there filling in for Brad Kellner, who's on vacation all week. Joe Cook in studio with us too. Both guys do an outstanding job with Inside Texas. Go check it out, InsideTexas.com. Also give them a follow on Twitter at JustinWells2424 and at JosephCook89 as well. Real quick look at the Specs text line before we take our first look at USC. It's unfortunate, but I think Shackelford is a player and person that has the chronic injury issues like the ankles. That sometimes is just sadly bad genetics, and the healing is also part of genetics. There's only so much that rehab can do for somebody like that. What do you guys think about that?
You can find excuses.
He has had surgeries on these ankles, I think, in each of the last two off seasons.
He has. And you never, injuries are a part of the game, and it's always the next man steps up. But at the same time, the nagging ones, the ones that reoccur, it's tough on an athlete, because it not only messes with your psyche, it messes with your confidence, and it also changes the trust in the coaches, because their job is to put the best 11 out there. And if Shackelford's not fully healthy, or he doesn't have, you know, if he's not one of the best five linemen, then that's a problem. And so it's a hard luck thing for Zach, because he's such a tough kid. He's a smart kid. But it's just, like you said, it started in high school, and you just hope that at some point he gets past that.
All right, it is time to fire up the Horns College Football Top 20.
The Horns College Football Top 20, brought to you by Reliable Automotive.
This is Carr, turns the corner, stutter step, still running, down inside the five, and Stephen Carr is the next guy at SC, and a terrific compliment to Jones.
Number 14, the USC Trojans.
We have to start each preview by talking about the fight song because each of these preview intros possesses either the fight song or a song that's representative of that university. Florida State's is the Tomahawk War Chant. What do you guys think about USC's fight song here?
I think it's a great one. I was at that game last year. Classic fight song, very college football. But the thing about the USC band is they play the same Tribute to Troy song pretty much every single down. Whoever was Oklahoma's band director probably transferred out to LA at some
Boomer
point.
Sooner.
Yeah, it is just constantly. And it's, you know, they wave the two fingers because apparently back in the ancient days, like free Trojans had their two fingers while slaves had their fingers cut off or something like that. So I think either that or V for Victory, maybe I'm just kind of embellishing there, but they wave that every single time and they play it every single down.
Well, the explanation is the former. That tradition may not last much longer in 2018. What say you, Justin?
In person, it's pretty cool because it's finished. The finish is the Trojan throwing the sword down into the ground.
Right.
And I remember being in Pasadena for the national championship in January of 2006, Texas USC. And once that sword went in the ground, it got real. That's when everything that had been built up into that game, it was like, okay, this is about to actually happen. So it's a fun fight song. If anybody has, you know, played NCAA college football as much as I have and religiously, you should know these fight songs by heart because if you need to memorize one, just play NCAA and play some different teams. You get a good taste of all of them.
And speaking of the fight song, that fight song is really enhanced when we're watching USC games on television and they cut to the shots of the USC cheerleaders in their sweaters as well. That really helps the fight song out too.
Amen.
All right, so USC, the football team, finished last year 11-3. They actually won the Pac-12, ended up playing in, I believe it was the Cotton Bowl. They ended up losing to a very inspired Ohio State team, 24-7 they lost that game. This is also a USC team, guys, that wasn't great defensively last year. And while they did have a bunch of nice pieces on offense, a lot of those guys are gone now. Sam Darnold, top three pick in the NFL draft. Ronald Jones, no longer a part of the equation. I believe he's with the Tampa Bay Bucks now. Deonte Burnett decided to leave after his junior year. He went undrafted, unfortunately for him. And they're going to be relying on youth at different skill positions this year. And that starts with the possibility of starting a kid who should be a senior in high school this year at quarterback.
JT Daniels, if you subscribe to Sports Illustrated, he was on the cover last week as the Gatorade High School National Player of the Year, an honor that former late Travis Garrett Gilbert also earned. Daniels is special. He's a great quarterback prospect. He's so young, and if he does become the starter, and we're going to talk more with USC guys here at the next hour, but most of those kids are young anyway,
right?
And Daniels is probably the best prospect, but you know, like you said, the kid graduated early. He should be focusing on possibly his senior year and things of that sort, and he's actually worrying about big time Division I football. Texas was in the same boat last year. And when they played each other, now the tables have turned. And I don't know who the guy's going to be, but let me tell you, at some point, JT Daniels is going to be special.
Matt Fink and Jack Sears also a part of that quarterback battle right now. And guys, when I look at this USC team, I think where they're rated versus what they actually are is epitomized by who is expected to be the starting running back. That is a kid by the name of Stephen Carr. You heard him in the highlight there. The ABC ESPN crew was all over him saying he was going to be the next great back at USC. I have to admit, though, watching him last year, going back and watching some of his quote-unquote highlights over the last couple of weeks, he's not a guy that I'm totally sold on as the next great running back at USC. And I think this USC football team he's a microcosm of this USC football team, the team being slightly overcooked right now by a lot of publications, many of whom have USC as a top 15 football team. They have entirely too many pieces that they're having to replace on offense. This defense, while they were good at getting to the quarterback last year, they were not great overall in terms of yardage allowed, also points per game allowed. They lost a lot of guys off the defense who actually got sacks for them. I think this USC team takes a pretty big step back. That's going to be evident by them not only losing week two to Stanford. I think Texas is going to handle the Trojans in week three too.
Yeah, what you mentioned about not only replacing Darnold, replacing Jones, that's replacing a guy who had 1,500 rushing yards and replacing him with a guy who only has 363. replacing a guy who had, you know, over 4,000 passing yards and now is coming in with zero. So that's replacing a backfield, as we've, as Texas fans have seen over the past few years, not an easy task to do. Even when you have that top team humming, it doesn't make it easy.
And Justin, you mentioned that Stephen Carr, while he will be this team's starting running back this year, that's not necessarily his natural position, though.
It's not. He's one of those guys that he's just so talented, you find a spot on the field for him. I think wide receiver or slot, maybe an all-purpose kind of guy, gadget back, maybe it might be his best position, just because he's not a natural running back. Now, if he gets in space or if he gets into the secondary, you're not going to catch him. It's evident. He's got that breakaway speed and that ability. But I don't think he's a natural running back. I think it's a position he's going to have to learn on the fly. I do think he's got a future in the NFL at wide receiver as a pass catcher. And don't forget, you know, some of the guys that they're having to replace, a gentleman named Jack Jones. He was the starting cornerback last year, number 25.
Right.
He's one of the best corners in the Pac-12, period. And I believe some of his stuff is either suspension, sanctions of some. I believe he had gotten a little bit of trouble. That's a big loss, because Jack Jones would have been the guy to try to shut down Colin Johnson, who actually had a career game last year against USC. And so you can't overlook those losses, not to mention the guys that have been getting hurt in scrimmage and in the fall practice so far, the Porter Goostons, the guys of that sort. And so by the time, you know, I didn't realize Stanford was the week before Texas. I mean, Texas had a lot of this is lining up for Texas to have an excellent shot at knocking off the Trojans in Austin.
Yeah, that Trojans defense is going to have all they can handle with Stanford the week before that. So you have to wonder if they aren't going to be a team licking their wounds coming in here to Austin the following week, because that's also their conference opener versus Stanford as well. So there are a lot of things on the line for the Trojans in week two. There is a saving grace for this USC football team right now, guys. It's a couple things. One, they return four or five starting offensive linemen. That clearly helps any situation, much less if you have a true freshman signal caller behind them. But also, despite the loss of Jack Jones, this looks like a USC secondary that looks to be pretty stout this year, starting with the guy, Iman Marshall, who may take over those Colin Johnson duties here in Austin.
Iman Marshall was probably one of my favorite recruits to watch at the opening. That kid was a natural corner. I mean, he's the kind of kid, he's the Jalen Ramsey mold. He just does everything well, got great hips, can turn in and out. He likes to track and smack. Iman Marshall, and it's one of those things where he flashed early. You want to see that guy progress, obviously not against Texas, but he is legit. When they talk about five stars, he's a five star.
Right, and they've got some talent in the back defensive backfield other places too. Marvell Tell, I remember, is a guy who at the safety position has done really well there. One name that popped out to me when I looked at their corner depth chart is Isaac Taylor Stewart. He's a freshman corner who, although I'm not sure if he's going to get a lot of time, he was one of the best corners I watched in last year's cycle. So,
Was he a Texas kid or just somebody national?
I think he was a national kid.
Okay.
Maybe
Georgia, something like that.
All right.
One of those two places, yeah, from San Diego. So whenever I got to watch his film, it really popped out to me. And so that's also a talented defense. That's a talented school as far as defensive backs go. It may not be one of those DBU argument schools like Texas and Florida and LSU always getting into it with each other. But there's been some good defensive backs to come out of USC and to be in that defensive backfield.
Other games to keep an eye on for this USC Trojans team this year on the schedule beyond Stanford Week 2, Texas Week 3. Both those games on the road, by the way. They're at Arizona at the end of September. And then it's an easier slate for them. Colorado at Utah, Arizona State at Oregon State, then Cal at home. And they finish things off at UCLA and then Notre Dame the Saturday before Thanksgiving, I believe. So schedule-wise, things ease up quite a bit after the first five games or so for the Trojans, but will that be too much for them to overcome at the end of the year? You'd have to imagine that this is going to be a Trojans team that will be a difficult squad to play at the end of the year. The start of the year, though, I'm just not so sure about that.
And it's eerie, the similarities to this USC team to last year's Texas team. They had the hard opening schedule, tough opening in conference, playing a lot of underclassmen with a new system. And then towards the end of the year, Texas was clicking. You know, by the Texas Bowl, you know, everybody pretty much knew where they were and what they needed to expect. The thing about USC is it's really the Pac-12 in general. I think it's really, really open. And I don't know if there's another conference. I don't know if there's another conference this year where the it's more open than that. I mean, Oregon's recruiting really well, and so Cristobal, they're trying to main, you know, get back what Chip Kelly left. Then you've got Chip Kelly at USC, at UCLA, who had, I believe, 7 or 8 career losses as a head coach. So and they're recruiting moderately well. It could be better. Sumlin down in Arizona, how good are they going to be with Khalil Tate, a returning guy? And so that conference is kind of wide open right now. It's going to be interesting to see kind of how those things play out.
The one thing is that most of the elite talent, the top three teams, or maybe three of the top four teams in that conference, are in the North, in Stanford, Washington, and Oregon.
Great
USC
point.
Is probably the other team in that group. So out of the South, I'm not sure who's really going to compete with USC. Is it Arizona with someone in Khalil Tate? Maybe, but I don't know if they have the talent top to bottom like USC does. Is it Arizona State and Herm Edwards? No.
No.
It's probably not going to be Chip Kelly, USC, in his first year there, even though there is some pieces there. But maybe Utah. I mean, that's always a team that has a stout defense. That's just Kyle Whittingham, just one of the best coaches in football.
That is a great point.
I don't know where that Utah USC game is this year. But,
that is at Utah,
right? And that, I mean, Kyle Whittingham loves playing these big teams. So while the North is maybe the one where there's a lot of intrigue with those top three schools and Stanford, Washington, Oregon, the South. Even if USC kind of stumbles through the year or walks through the year, they could still get to the Pac-12 title game.
And it's not let it be forgotten, Colorado has really recruited well in the last 2 years, especially in the state of Texas. They have come into Texas and grabbed 3 or 4 guys every year, and Colorado's got a nice little tradition. It's a great college town, and beautiful stadium in Boulder. It's like right in nestled in between the mountains. You can see the snow tops. It's really a beautiful place to go watch a game. I love Joe bringing up Utah because Utah is one of the best coach teams in all of college football. Colorado is another team that could be coming up.
And they got a lot to prove because they had that big 10-win year in 2016, kind of had some off-the-field troubles, and then this last year everything kind of fell right down. So it's a lot to prove for Mike McIntyre up there.
Great points, guys. We had such a good USC conversation that we're actually going to delay where we at in society until the following segment. Yes, you may want to reconsider peeing in the pool. I know all of you people do it. I'm going to ask these guys if they've ever peed in the pool before. Joe is shaking his head right now. I'm going to have
morning.
To call Joe a damn dirty liar if he actually says that into the microphone. That's coming up next, where we at in society. This is the Midday Show. I'm Trey Elling. Brad Kellner out this week. Justin Wells filling in through Friday. Joe Cook in studio for the next 20 minutes or so, and this is The Horn. Back here on Midday with Trey and BK, Brad Kellner on vacation, Justin Wells filling in. Joe Cook, also of the Inside Texas family, is in studio with us through the rest of the hour. Before we get to where we at in society, we have a Jack Jones update, former USC cornerback. We were wondering during the commercial break whether he transferred someplace else or is still a part of the team in some capacity. And Joe Cook, you looked up what's going on with Jack Jones. What's up?
So the headline starts off with ex-USC football player Jack Jones arrested, charged with breaking into Panda Express at 3 a.m.
Oh, that's just poor decisions right there. If you're going to break into someplace at 3 a.m., first of all, kids out there, don't break into someplace. Also, for you kids out there, because if excuse me, if you're listening right now, wow, you're hearing me struggle through dealing with some turmeric in my throat, but also you're probably not going through orientation, so you're already on the wrong path, so you may very well be breaking into places at 3 a.m. Don't break into Panda Express at 3 a.m. That's just a poor choice.
Didn't Golden Tate break into a Krispy Kreme in his first camp with the Seattle Seahawks? Was that Golden Tate?
Did he really?
Remember, it was like 3 in the morning, and it was part of the facility somewhat, and so he thought, well, since it's adjoined with it, you can sort of slide in here and get his Krispy Kreme on, which are literally bags of sugar.
Did he just get that right?
Seattle Times headline, the great maple bar caper, Seahawks Golden Tate caught in 3 a.m. visit to Top Pot Donut.
Top Pot Donut. I almost understand the donut shop bit at 3 a.m. more so than Panda Express, because that's when the donuts are being cooked up. So
yeah.
Perhaps you're just inspired by the smell that you hear coming from the building.
We've all been guilty of that.
Only issued a warning, though.
Only issued a warning, really. That's a boy, gutsy move by the cops there. Maybe they're Seahawks fans.
Right, but I do believe it was in like part of the facility, so maybe he felt, well, since I'm a Seahawk, I've got, you know,
that makes
precedent.
A little bit more sense versus some random Panda Express.
But he only, I believe he only played very an underwhelming two seasons coming out of Notre Dame, then went to Detroit and actually had a breakout year with Stafford a year or two ago.
He really did. All right, let's hit it's time for...
Where are we at in society today?
This segment brought to you by Student Loan Payment Lawn Care. Call or text Jake today for a free estimate, 512-653-0687, or visit slplawncare.com.
I can absolutely vouch for the job that Jake and his crew of 15 or so guys do all over Central Texas. That's because they've been coming out to my place in Cedar Park, and they've done an awesome job first on the lawn and also the bushes as well. Whether you're like us and you just don't have the time, unfortunately, to do yourself right now, the wife and I both working long hours. Maybe you're also like us. The person that you have hired, the neighborhood kid, is just butchering your lawn. Go ahead and give Jake at SLP Lawn Care a call. Go to slplawncare.com for more info. Guys, I previewed it last segment. Have you ever peed in the pool? Each of you ever peed in the pool? We'll start with you, Justin.
Yes, I have, because I am human. I've been swimming since I was 4 years old. I will admit, when we were told by the lifeguard, I was probably 7 or 8 years old, when I was told by the lifeguard that if you peed in the pool, a purple ring would get around you and everyone would know that you did. That's when I stopped.
That's one of those effective urban myths. I don't know if that chemical actually exists, but that stopped me before, too.
It stopped me, and then when I got older and learned that it was a myth, I went back to doing it. So, sorry, that's the truth. I'm not going to lie.
Joe Cook, what about you? Have you peed in the pool before?
The only place I have ever swam in and peed in is the Atlantic Ocean.
So you're saying in a swimming pool, you have never actually done number one.
Why would I want to swim in my own pee, let alone other people? Pee.
All right.
Oh, it's chlorinated or salt water, so there's still pee.
Perhaps that is some rationale. I'm of the standpoint that there are two type of people in this world: people who have peed in the pool before and damn dirty liars. So I guess you're in the latter category, Joe Cook. However, maybe you want to reconsider the next time you do think about peeing in the pool. Look, as an adult, I don't do it anymore, but definitely as a kid, and even sometimes as an adult, I've done so. Who at their life, at some point in their life, hasn't done it in the pool, maybe even the ocean, something like that. But it turns out peeing into a chlorinated pool is a really bad thing for you guys. Really bad. This is according to a new study published in a journal by the American Chemistry Society that looked at what happens when urine and chlorine interact. The researchers mixed uric acid, found in urine, with chlorine. Within an hour, they found both trichloramine and cyanogen chloride had formed. These two chemicals are frequently found in chlorinated swimming pools. Exposure to one has been linked to respiratory problems, and the other can cause serious issues to the lungs as well, and also the central nervous system and cardiovascular system, according to the CDC.
So you're telling me I'm saving lives?
I'm telling you that you have been saving lives this entire time, Justin and I, possibly causing respiratory issues for people all over the state of Texas, and I will be doing less of that going forward.
I feel like I'm getting shamed way too early in the morning.
Well, at least we're not bringing up stories about dog saliva costing people their arms and legs or their lives. By the way, did you see the story from Leonis Martin yesterday? He's in serious condition, was traded from Detroit to the Cleveland Indians at the trade deadline. He's actually in the hospital right now fighting for his life because of a bacterial infection. Now, there's no proof that this is the case or not. I hope this isn't a dog bit. I hope Leonis didn't let his dog lick him in the face, and all of a sudden he's fighting for his life now because of it.
That's the very first thing when I saw that headline, I thought of that. I said, you know, this, because it's the second time we had heard about it yesterday. And so I'm thinking, is this a trend? Is this like a real thing? And so prayers to Leonis, the former Texas Rangers hot top prospect and farmhand. Man, I hope it isn't that. I hope it's something that's it's easily fixed. But yeah, he's in bad shape right now.
No doubt about that. Thoughts to Leonis and his family, indeed, and hopefully he can make a speedy recovery. Real quick look at baseball. Joe, since you are an Astros fan, you're wearing the Astros pullover in the studio right now. What do you make of the current slump that this team is going through? Clearly they're missing some guys, although they've gotten Carlos Correa back. Do you think that this is just one of the typical swoons that we see a team go through during a 162-game baseball season? Are the Astros in serious trouble right now?
They're in serious trouble if people don't get healthy. I think last year what you saw was Dallas Keuchel, I think even Lance McCullers went on extended periods of time on the DL, but they weren't hurt. It was just, well, you got through the 10 days, you're fine, but we really don't need to rush you back. And that was at that point when Mike Fiers was carrying the team.
That's right.
That happened last year. This year, and that's when the team still had its, you know, unbelievable record-setting offense.
Mm-hmm.
Roles have kind of flipped this year. The pitching's great. Charlie Morton, Garrett Cole, Verlander, Keuchel's starting to figure it out a little bit more. But the thing is, all the bats that were there last year through this entire time are now hurt. I mean, Springer's messed up his hand. Altuve, hopefully his leg gets a little bit better.
That should be a concern for you guys. That's right now. He got sent home from that West Coast trip because his knee was not responding to treatment very well. They're taking a further look at that when he still can't run just yet. So that's something that you have to imagine would keep him out for at least another couple weeks.
Right. And so, I mean, just kind of looking at this month's schedule, good little swing against the NL West, 1-4 or 5 out there. But then you get swept by the Mariners over 4 games. You're, you know, a team that's only a few games back of you. That lets the A's catch up to you. They need to get healthy, and they need to get healthy fast. If that pitching keeps going, it's not going to matter if, you know, your ERA can be 2, but if you're scoring 0, it doesn't really matter.
Astros start a series with the Colorado Rockies at home tonight. That's followed by a weekend series back out west that may have something serious to say about the current standings in the division. That is against the Oakland A's, who are currently, I believe, they won last night. So they're 2 games back from the Astros in that Western Division. None of us thought a month ago that anybody was going to catch the Astros in the West, but it looks like Oakland stands a chance.
And how, and this, because, you know, from the way the Rangers have played since the All-Star break, how good is this division? This might be the best division in baseball from top to bottom. With Houston, Oakland, Seattle, the LA Angels when Trout is healthy, which, you know, that's been killing my fantasy baseball team because Trout's been out for at least like 3 weeks now. And then the Rangers coming on. You got a guy like Ronald Guzman who went yard again last night. I mean, he's like Big Al. He just hits dingers. And so you got to look at this division, but I think Houston's going to be just fine. I really do. I think bringing in Osuna, as controversial as it is, will really stabilize the bullpen because he's still a top five closer in the game. You can't argue that. I think the bats will come along a little bit later. I don't know about McCullers. I wonder if he's actually going to be. There's talk that he may not pitch again this year.
Wow, really?
And that's, well, you got to be cautious when it comes to the tight arm, the forearm, things of that sort. You might be looking at Tommy John, things of this thing. And the fact that it happened during batting practice, swinging a bat, just kind of, you know, puts even more of a downer on it. But Houston is still solid. Oakland is really peaking right now. You know, when you got the bullpen, they have the incredible bullpen. When you got Sean Manaea as one of the best pitchers, Jed Lowry's having a great year. Chris Davis with a K is doing what he's always done, but now people are paying attention to it. Seattle's always a tough out. And then you've got the Rangers and the Angels that don't want to just rebuild. The Rangers the other night had 7 starters under 25 years old, and that doesn't count Nomar Mazara, who's a 2-year vet, who's 24 years old. And so it's a tough division. I think it'll make Houston better. I think Boston is still probably the best team in the AL.
Yep.
But until we see Boston and Houston play for the American League pennant, the Astros are still the champs, and they still have to be dethroned.
The one thing is that the next 16 games for the Astros against AL West opponents. So if they want to be able to make some room in the division, or if bad things happen, these next 16 games are really going to have some of the most impact on the team of any other game this year.
Great points. Joe, thank you so much for hanging out this hour. I know you've got to get over to the practice post-media session with Tom Herman, hopefully some players as well. But we appreciate your perspective on things and look forward to talking to you at some point again in the near future.
Anytime.
He is Joe Cook of Inside Texas. Sitting across from me is Justin Wells, also of Inside Texas. Justin filling in for BK, who's on vacation the rest of the week. This is the Midday Show. Coming up next, we will further our USC football preview with John Jackson, former USC wideout turned radio analyst for Trojans football broadcast. He'll join the Midday Show here on the Horn.